for attending today's Bhagavatam class. I hope it's pleasing to the assembled devotees, to Srila Prabhupada, and to the presiding deities here at New Dwarka Dham. So we're reading from the first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. This is the 18th chapter. We're very near the end of this chapter when we're reading today verse 47. So please repeat after me. Apapeshu svabhrityeshu Malina pokvabudhina Papam krtam tad bhagavan Sarvatma chantam arhati Apapeshu svabhrityeshu Bhalena pakva buddhina papankritang tad bhagavan sarvatma chantum arhati. Please chant. Papeshu svavritteshu Bhalina pakva buddhina papankritang tad bhagavan sarvatma chantum arhati. Bhaveshu svabhrityeshu Bhalina pakva buddhina papankritang tad bhagavan sarvatma chantum arhati. Bhaveshu svabhrityeshu Bhalina pakva buddhina Papam kritam tad bhagavan sarvatma chantum arhati. Bhaveshu svabhrityeshu Bhalina pakva buddhina Papam kritam tad bhagavan sarvatma chantum arhati. Bhaveshu svabhrityeshu Bhalina pakva buddhina Papam kritam tad bhagavan sarvatma chantum arhati. Vaishnavis, please. Bhaveshu svabhrityeshu Bhalina pakva buddhina Papam kritam tad bhagavan sarvatma chantum arhati. Bhaveshu svabhrityeshu Bhalina pakva buddhina Papam kritam tad bhagavan sarvatma chantum arhati. Bhaveshu svabhrityeshu Bhalina pakva buddhina Papam kritam tad bhagavan sarvatma chantum arhati. Apapeshu, unto one who is completely free from all sins. Svabhrityeshu, unto one who is subordinate and deserves to be protected. Bhalina, by a child. Apakva, who is immature. Buddhina, by intelligence. Papam, sinful act. Kritam, has been done. Tat Bhagavan, therefore the personality of Godhead. Sarva Atma, who is all-pervading. Jantum, just to pardon. Arhati, deserve. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. I'm going to ask you to repeat the first time, and then I'll recite it alone. So translation, then the Rishi prayed to the all-pervading personality of Godhead. Please repeat. To pardon his immature boy, who had no intelligence, and who committed the great sin of cursing a person who was completely free from all sins, who was subordinate, and who deserved to be protected. Then the Rishi prayed to the all-pervading personality of Godhead to pardon his immature boy who had no intelligence and who committed the great sin of cursing a person who was completely free from all sins, who was subordinate, and who deserved to be protected. Prabhupada's purport. Everyone is responsible for his own action, either pious or sinful. Rishi Shamika could foresee that his son had committed a great sin by cursing Maharaj Parikshit, who deserved to be protected by the Brahmanas, for he was a pious ruler and completely free from all sins because of his being a first-class devotee of the Lord. When an offense is done unto the devotee of the Lord, it is very difficult to overcome the reaction. The Brahmanas, being at the head of the social orders, are meant to give protection to their subordinates and not to curse them. There are occasions when a Brahmana may furiously curse a subordinate, Kshatriya or Vaishya, etc. But in the case of Maharaj Parikshit, there were no grounds, as already explained. The foolish boy had done it out of sheer vanity in being a Brahmin's son, and thus he became liable to be punished by the laws of God. The Lord never forgives a person who condemns his pure devotee. Therefore, by cursing a king, the foolish Shringi had committed not only a sin, but also the greatest offense. Therefore, the Rishi could foresee that only the Supreme Personality of Godhead could save his boy from his sinful act. He therefore directly prayed for pardon from the Supreme Lord, who alone can undo a thing which is impossible to change. The appeal was made in the name of a foolish boy who had developed no intelligence at all. A question may be raised herein that since it was the desire of the Lord that Parikshit Maharaj be put into that awkward position so that he might be delivered from material existence, then why was a Brahmin's son made responsible for this offensive act? The answer is that the offensive act was performed by a child only, so that he could be excused very easily, and thus the prayer of the father was accepted. But if the question is raised why the Brahmana community as a whole was made responsible for allowing Kali into the world affairs, the answer is given in the Varaha Purana, that the demons who had acted inimically toward the personality of Godhead, but were not killed by the Lord, were allowed to take birth in the families of Brahmanas to take advantage of the age of Kali. The all-merciful Lord gave them a chance to have their births in the families of pious Brahmanas so that they could progress toward salvation. But the demons, instead of utilizing the good opportunity, misuse the Brahminical culture due to being puffed up by vanity in becoming Brahmanas. The typical example is the son of Samik Rishi. And all the foolish sons of Brahmanas are warned hereby not to become as foolish as Shringi, and to be always on guard against the demoniac qualities which they had in their previous births. The foolish boy was, of course, excused by the Lord, but others who may not have a father like Shamik Rishi will be put into great difficulty if they misuse the advantages obtained by birth in a Brahmin family. Papeshu sabkeshu balina pukva buddhina papam krittam tad bhagavan sarvatma chantum arhati. I offer my respectful obeisances unto His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada, who is very dear to Lord Krishna on this earth, having taken complete shelter at His lotus feet. Our respectful obeisances are unto you, O spiritual master servant of Saraswati Goswami. You are kindly preaching the message of Lord Chaitanya Dev and delivering the Western countries, which are filled with impersonalism and voidism. So in today's class, we're going to visit four themes. We'll look at some of the personality types that feature in the Bhagavatam. We'll examine the importance of honest self-assessment in spiritual life. That will be our emphasis. We'll look at the different stages of devotees that we find in our movement. And then we'll take a brief look at the history prior to the period that we're now studying in the Bhagavatam. So, part one. The Srimad Bhagavatam is, among other things, a fascinating character study of some extraordinary personalities. There are incarnations of Krishna, including plenary incarnations and portions of plenary portions and Shaktivesh avatars. And by the way, if anyone here understands the difference between a plenary portion and a portion of a plenary portion and can explain that, please give a class on that for the benefit of the entire community. So, continuing the list, in the Bhagavatam, you have your absolutely pure, spotless devotees of Krishna. The residents of Raj come to mind. Then you have pure devotees of who, by Krishna's will, seem to become temporarily infected by the modes of nature and then transcend that apparent fall in order to provide a life lesson to everyone. You have your pure devotees who assume completely demonic lives. Jai and Vijay come to mind. You have personalities who are demonic from start to finish, although if they have the good fortune of being killed by Krishna or one of his incarnations, then they achieve some kind of liberation. Think Kamsa or King Vena. You have Brahmavadis who become attracted to the personal form of Krishna and who take birth and who turn into exalted devotees of Krishna. The four Kumars are an example. And finally, you have persons who take birth in exalted families who throw away their spiritual gifts and come under the sway of the modes of nature. And you have exalted managers of universal affairs who are devotees of Krishna, but who are so powerful that they get caught up in their power and position. Think Lord Indra or King Daksha. So in the chapters we're now reading, Maharaj Parikshit is a spotless devotee of Krishna, but briefly placed in a compromising situation when he becomes subject to thirst and fatigue and commits a minor offense against Shamik Rishi. Now later on, when he's faced with the ultimate adversity of being cursed to die, he exhibits extraordinary qualities by abstaining from food, sleep, and water for the final 7 days of his life, which results in the highest benefit for the entire universe. We have Sringi, Shamik Rishi's son, who takes birth in a spiritually exalted family but throws it away because he's prideful of his high birth. And we have Shukdev Goswami, a Brahmin realized soul who becomes a pure devotee of Krishna when he hears his father, Srila Vyasadeva's recitation of the Srimad Bhagavatam, and thus becomes qualified to recite the most exalted of all Vedic literatures. Part two. The obvious purpose of these character studies in the Srimad Bhagavatam is to glorify the Lord and His devotees. But another purpose is to inspire us to do our own character study so that our lives become an ongoing and honest assessment of our spiritual progress and our shortcomings. And you know what? That's not as easy as it sounds. For example, pretty much all of us were born into Tamasic situations. And that Tamasic conditioning is not that easy to overcome. Now, I occasionally hear people denigrating the mode of passion, Rajagun, as if it were something from our distant past. And I'm saying that Rajagun or even Sattvagun are, am I saying that there's something to aspire to? Well, if we're born into Tamagun and dominated by Tamagun, Rajagun is not a bad intermediate destination on our way to Shuddhasattva or pure goodness, just as if in baseball, if you want to reach home plate, you have to pass first and second and third bases. Kshatriyas are ruled by the mode of passion. And Krishna describes the qualities of Kshatriyas in the Bhagavad Gita, 1843, Saryam tejo dittir daksham yude chapyapalayanam dhanamisharabhavascha chattam karmasabhavajam. Quote, heroism, power, determination, resourcefulness, courage in battle, generosity, and leadership are the natural qualities of work for the Kshatriyas. So yes, I aspire to reach the mode of passion on the way to goodness if I become imbued with such admirable qualities. Well, then you may say, if I'm chanting Hare Krishna and I'm following the four regulative principles, aren't I automatically in the mode of goodness? Not necessarily. Prabhupada gave the example of unplugging a fan and the blades of the fan gradually slowing down. Becoming free of our past karma, the influence of the lower modes, is gradual. Sattvagun is extremely rare in this world. Why? Because Sattvagun is the predominating quality of Satyayug when everyone lived for 100,000 years and there was no need for varnas and ashramas because almost everyone was self-controlled and devoted to spiritual life. Then, in Tretayug, people lived for just 10,000 years and most of them were Brahmins and Kshatriyas. Well, take a guess which mode of nature became prominent in the Tretayuga. You guessed it. The mode of passion. Then in Dwarapa Yuga, the modes of passion and ignorance were prominent. And what does that leave for this blessed Kali Yuga? Right, Tamagun, the mode of ignorance. And that's why I say that Tamagun is practically the only mode of nature that's active in this age. Kali Yuga is the age of darkness, and darkness equals Tamagun. But what if we see someone who is kind to others or who is a little peaceful or loving or charitable? Can't we say, oh, he or she is in the mode of goodness? Well, there may be some goodness since the modes of nature are always competing with each other. But as described in the second and third chapters of the 12th canto of the Bhagavatam, what rules this age basically is Tamagun with very few exceptions. Now, if I chant 16 rounds and follow the four regular principles, although who can honestly say they don't feel lust from time to time, that's my ticket to rise above the modes of nature, but it doesn't mean I've actually transcended them. Remember, this is a gradual process. Because of my past karma, I am in the grips of the modes of nature, and actually breaking free is no cheap thing. Anyway, I was talking about a character study, a kind of self-assessment as an essential component of one's spiritual life. And one proof that I'm beginning to transcend Tamagun is that I'm even able to conduct a self-assessment. If I'm dominated by Tamagun, then I'm pretty much too engrossed in my own false ego to even step outside of it to take an honest look at myself. And now I'm going to get personal. Looking back, I was so covered by Tamagun for almost the first 20 years of my devotional life that I was unable to make an honest assessment of my factual situation in the modes of nature. And instead, I thought that I was God's gift to the movement. And what's that saying? Pride cometh before a fall. And boy, did I fall. So, I suggest that each one of us for the good of our own advancement in Krishna consciousness, check in regularly and honestly and try to assess where we are in terms of the modes of material nature. And if one of the lower modes becomes prominent, at least acknowledge that and pray to Krishna to release us. Okay, we're going to do a little exercise now, a kind of self-assessment, to see if any of the following qualities apply to us. Now, I apologize in advance if this becomes a little discouraging or sounds a little negative, because there is hope, and I will provide that hope. Okay, I'm going to fuel up first. If I'm critical, negative, argumentative, irritable, that's a huge one for me. If I can't keep away from meaningless online activity or excessive connection with what we call the news, if I need the distraction of mundane sound or stories or images to relax, if I'm sluggish or tired a lot of the time, if I lament or complain a lot, if I'm sad or depressed, if I have aggressive or violent feelings towards myself or others, if I'm groggy, dull-headed, distracted, or can't concentrate, if I'm stingy or a hoarder, if I'm hypocritical, if I'm feeling lots of fear or anxiety, if I constantly lose things, if I hold grudges, if I'm bitter or play the victim, blaming others for my difficulties, if I'm subject to compulsive or addictive behaviors such as compulsive overeating or obsession with sex or any addiction for that matter, if I'm judgmental, oh, he's so fat and she looks ridiculous in that sari, if I'm overly stubborn or unreasonable, if I'm expert in insulting others, if I love hearing about the faults and failings of others, if I'm sarcastic, impatient, fidgety, or nervous, if I'm inclined to use foul language, if I feel toxic shame or am excessively self-critical, if I tend to procrastinate and be late, if I regularly bump my head, stub my toe, or am prone to other accidents, if I drop things or break things, if I'm envious, if I feel prejudice against someone because of their nationality, skin color, or even their sexual orientation, if I'm easily frustrated, if I'm spiteful, if my plans never materialize, the list goes on and on and on. Whenever any of these qualities manifest in me, know it for certain that I'm in the grips of the mode of darkness, tamagun. And to the degree that I'm covered by tamagun, it can hardly be said that I'm engaged in devotional service, which, remember, is transcendental to the modes of nature. At best, I'm engaged in some shadow of devotional service. So then if my reaction to all this is, oh my God, it's hopeless, I'm so worthless, I'm so fallen, I'll never make any advancement. If that's my reaction, guess what? That's also tamagun. We know that the mode of darkness has nothing in common with the soul. And besides that, I'm trying to act on the platform of the soul. So why am I still so enmeshed in tamagun? Now, you may not be happy with the answer, but partly it's because I'm attracted to tamagun. I somehow find shelter in it. I've become accustomed to it. I've become, and here's the operative word, conditioned to it. And that's why I'm called a conditioned soul. Okay, we're done with the hard part. Part three. Now I'm going to be even a little bit more audacious and make a sweeping assessment of ISKCON devotees in general. But here's where the good news comes in. I'd say that most of us in ISKCON are sincerely engaged in sadhana bhakti and serving Prabhupada's movement, but a fair majority of us still spend a great deal of time and energy battling the modes of nature and somehow catering to our material desires. I definitely include myself in that list. I spend most of my time just keeping body and soul together and trying to arrange a reasonably comfortable situation so I can chant my rounds and render a little service. Now, contrast that with the pure devotee about whom it is said that Krishna takes complete charge of his bodily maintenance and survival. The pure devotee is practically not conscious of his bodily needs except if it offers an opportunity for his disciples to render service. Now, in the second category of ISKCON devotees, this is just my observation, this is not from Shastra, a certain percentage of us actually spend more time and energy thinking about and executing our service to Prabhupada than we do thinking about or maintaining our bodies. We may still feel mundane emotions, anxiety, lust, envy, and so forth, but we're solidly motivated by our service to Prabhupada and are willing to tolerate inconvenience and difficulty year after year in order to perform our service. Think full-time or even part-time book distributors or practically anyone who is serving Prabhupada's mission full-time. And in the third category, a small percentage of ISKCON devotees worldwide have basically become what I call thoroughbreds. They may not be totally free of material desires, but the vast majority of their life energy, say 80, 85, 90%, is immersed in serving Prabhupada and spreading Krishna consciousness. And many of these devotees were born in tamasic Western families totally outside the purview of Vedic civilization. And that's what should give us hope, that people born in tamasic families, in tamasic cultures, completely outside the Vedic culture, that such people who are our god brothers and sisters, our god cousins, our god uncles and aunts, who have wholeheartedly devoted themselves to Guru and Gauranga, they have actually transcended their material destiny, their material karma, because the process of devotional service under the guidance of a pure devotee is very, very powerful, and in fact, is the only way in this age to make real spiritual progress. And that reminds me of my dear friend and godbrother, Apoorva Prabhu. Now, Apoorva was here until a week ago, testing recipes for his upcoming book on preparing prasadam in quantity. A good part of his service is to remind us and to show by example that prasadam is an important spiritual component of our lives. Prasadam is not just legal sense gratification or just meant to keep body and soul together. No. Prasadam, when respected in the proper consciousness, is a powerful and potent spiritual tool, both in our lives and in the lives of those who may be newcomers to Krishna consciousness. I took to Apoorva so spontaneously. He has such good qualities, a strong service attitude, kindness and gentleness fixed in his sadhana. He was humble enough to create an evaluation sheet so that devotees could give him honest feedback on his feast preparations. Now, how many of us are so free of false ego and eager to improve that we create a checklist on which other devotees can describe our faults and shortcomings? What a blessing to have a friend like Apoorva, and just like Apoorva Prabhu, befriended and inspired so many of us. We, each and every one of us, should also aspire to provide friendship and encouragement to others. Finally, part four. Sri Dayananda Maharaj gives an interesting synopsis of the history leading up to the events in the Mahabharata. When the incarnation, Parashuram, annihilated the Kshatriyas 21 times, basically there were no Kshatriyas left to repopulate the royal order. So as was common in those days, saintly persons were called upon to create progeny in the ruling class. And the result was an entire generation, an entire earth practically, of saintly men and women who were supposed to be rulers, but instead were more interested in pursuing spiritual life. So the earth became very sattvic, but unprotected. Meanwhile, on a universal scale, the demons were looking for an obscure place in the planetary systems from which to launch their plan to take over the universe. And what better place than the earth? a tiny, lower, middle-class planet where they would meet with no opposition from this race of humans that was more interested in renunciation than ruling. So they took birth in powerful Kshatriya families on Earth, including pious Krishna-conscious families, with the intention of taking over the Earth and from there the entire universe. Talk about a conspiracy. And that's the situation from which the famous opening lines of chapter 1 of the Krishna book proceed, quote, "Once the world was overburdened by the unnecessary defense force of different kings who were actually demons but were posing themselves as the royal order." So in the purport to today's verse, Prabhupada cites the version from the Varaha Purana about demons who acted inimically toward the personality of Godhead but were not killed by the Lord. They were allowed to take birth in families of Brahmins to take advantage of the age of Kali. So this is a parallel situation, you could say. Demons taking birth in Brahmin families as opposed to taking birth in Kshatriya families. And the events that Prabhupada cites appear to have occurred at a later date than what I was referring to earlier, for the incidents I was referring to occurred long before the age of Kali. And the incidents Prabhupada referred to occurred when the age of Kali had already begun. But there are still interesting parallels. Anyway, in this section of the Srimad Bhagavatam, Shamik Rishi's son, Sringi, was heartless and puffed up, but his father understood the gravity of his son's misdeed because he understood both Maharaj Parikshit's spiritually exalted position and his exalted position as a saintly king. Samyak Rishi didn't defend his son or try to rationalize his actions. Rather, he did practically the only thing one could do in such a situation. He glorified Maharaj Parikshit and prayed to the Supreme Personality of Godhead to pardon his son for his heinous cursing of the king. So today's verse once again. Then the Rishi prayed to the all-pervading Personality of Godhead to pardon his immature boy who had no intelligence and who committed the great sin of cursing a person who was completely free from all sins, who was subordinate, and who deserved to be protected. Ending quite early, not that I'm equipped to answer your questions, but if you have some comments, the floor is yours. Hare Krishna. Prabhu.
Yeah, you mentioned in our society we have different types of devotees and different levels of Krishna consciousness. And you mentioned different percentages and like that. How does one understand these different percentages?
Purely observational. I think I did mention that this is my observation and is not from Shastra. But we see some extremely exalted, and many of them are very well known, devotees, disciples of Srila Prabhupada. Prabhupada said that one gauge of one's advancement is his or her ability to bring others to Krishna consciousness. And there's some people who technically we could call God brothers, but they're practically like spiritual masters to many of us who technically, as I say, are God brothers. So again, this was just to kind of give an observation that devotional service is a process of purification. And most of us start, at least most of us who are Western born, we start with very humble beginnings. And we gradually make progress. And then I look and I see around me people who are just so absorbed every waking moment in giving Krishna to others and in hearing transcendental sound vibration. That's why it seems to me that they're practically 80, 85, 90% absorbed in Krishna Katha. It may be 100%, but that we know is the pure devotee who 24 hours a day does not give up his service. Does that help?
Yeah, I was thinking the statement Prabhupada said about nobody has to give you a certificate that you're Krishna conscious. You know yourself. Just like if you're hungry, if you eat, you know you're satisfied. Nobody has to tell you you're satisfied.
Excellent.
So I'm thinking in terms of it's everybody individually knows. It's like an more like an internal thing for everyone. And that we should just respect all the devotees and associate those we feel are more advanced, and in this way we won't commit any offenses.
I agree with you, but I gave an example from my own attempt at devotional service that the mode of darkness was so present in me that it covered me to be able to honestly assess my situation, which led to a lot of trouble. And so you say that most of us are aware. I would say part of the process of Krishna consciousness, as we become more conscious of Krishna, we become more conscious of ourselves and where we are on the spiritual path. So, yes, that's my hope and prayer that all of us can, and that's why emphasize this particular portion of the class, that we can honestly make self-assessments. Krishna consciousness, at least by my understanding, is a very self-reflective process. It's not an automatic process. It's not just 16 rounds and four principles, although that's important. That's something, that's the baseline, something we have to do. But by my understanding, it's a process of deep looking within and honestly saying, where am I now and where can I improve? And then day after day, striving to make that improvement. Is that okay?
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Prabhu, for giving a very elaborated descriptions of all the all those bad qualities that we may have. But I don't know if you... I think in your talk you mentioned that you will give the hope. I don't know. I think you said better. If you did, and then if you allow me to, I can tell you something, mention something. He's so beautiful. By Srila Rupa Goswami. He says that, oh, my Lord, I do not have any love for you, nor am I qualified for discharging devotional service by chanting and hearing, nor do I possess the mystical power of a Vaishnava, knowledge or pious activities, nor do I belong to a very high caste family. On the whole, I do not possess anything still, O beloved of the gopis, because you bestow your mercy on the most fallen. I have an unbreakable hope that is constantly in my heart, and that hope is always giving me pain.
Krishna consciousness is filled with sublime contradictions. The more exalted I factually become in my consciousness, the less worthy I feel. And someone who has absolutely no sense of spiritual life often feels him or herself just like, you know, the greatest, like God's gift to earth. So these, another contradiction, that Krishna, who is the supreme, powerful, and is the source of everything and everyone, submits himself to the will of his devotee and allows himself, as we've been celebrating this last month, to be bound by his mother when no one can bind the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So the sublime contradictions in Krishna consciousness are relishable, and I think you touched on some of them. Thank you.
If you allow me to, speaking about contradictions, there's another one here that is, makes it think. This is from the third canto of the Vahuti to Lord Krishna when he says, oh, how glorious are they whose tongues are chanting your holy name. Even if born in the families of dog eaters, such persons are worshipful persons who chant the holy name of your lordship, must have executed all kinds of austerities and fire sacrifices and achieve all the good manners of the Aryans. To be chanting the holy name of your lordship, they must have bathed at holy places, on pilgrimage, study the Vedas, and fulfilling everything required. So we see that many in the practice of Krishna consciousness, many devotees are doing that, and many devotees we follow on the descriptions that you gave to. And then it appears here that, oh, but they're chanting Hare Krishna. So how can you explain that?
Okay. Arjita has a response.
No. His first question was about hope. I was just listening to a lecture by Prabhupada last night, and Prabhupada said, Krishna becomes the devotee of his devotee. He said, don't forget that. The more you become devoted to Krishna, he becomes devoted to you. It's not that only when you get to the pure platform. The more you surrender and devote, Prabhupada really stressed, devote your energy and time to Krishna, then Krishna devotes his time and energy to you. And that's the hope. That's the hope. It's not by our strength again. Because again, we start thinking, well, if I become more introspective and if I do this and I do that, then I will. And no, it's Krishna. You devote yourself to Krishna, and Prabhupada was stressing, even quoted Apichet Sudaracharya, even if you still have some bad habits, if you devote yourself to Krishna, Krishna devotes himself to you, and that's what takes you to the pure platform. Mm. Why Krishna devoted himself to you. Mm. Again, we keep thinking it's our strength. If I become pure, if I do this, if I become more this, and I become that. No, it's Krishna. Yes, you have to follow the spiritual master's guidelines. And Prabhupada, in this lecture, was stressing, devote yourself to Krishna. In other words, don't let your attention be diverted. And that's why he quoted Apichet Sudaracharya, because we can see bad qualities in ourselves and in others. But if you remain fixed on the devotional path, fixed on Krishna, Krishna devotes himself to you, and then you become successful.
Thank you. And on that note, we shall end. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Hare Krishna.